Welcome to Hot Boga. This podcast is sponsored by ASAC Camo, the camo you wear hunting, not on a date. All right, next one up. Our next sponsor is New Breed Archery. Check out their custom options at newbreedarchery.com and have your next bow shipped direct to your door.
All right. Next one is Black Eagle Arrows. I miss the target a lot, and I have yet to break a Black Eagle Arrow. I don't know why. I don't know what kind of voodoo magic they use to make these things so strong, but I love it. Check them out.
Our next sponsor is Steerka Optics. Stay Steerka strong and check out a whole new level of optics with unparalleled clarity and an unparalleled warranty.
Are you Steerka strong?
That was weak.
Strong.
I wasn't ready.
That'll get cut out.
You know, that'll get cut out.
Yeah, that'll get cut out.
That's fine. All right, next up is Seek Outside. They make incredibly strong, light gear. So if you want a light pack that can haul a lot of weight, if you want to be warm in a teepee out in the middle of the woods, check them out. They make amazing gear. Seek Outside. Finally, our last sponsor is Burris. They make some fantastic, innovative, durable, and accurate products, especially the new Oracle bow sight. It's going to change the way you hunt. Check them out.
Well, we had five of us that were going to hunt this better unit in Oregon for mule deer as a draw unit, and it's over in Eastern Oregon, so we're getting into the mule deer. And I've never actually targeted mule deer with a bow. It's always been elk hunting and then, hey, look, there's a mule deer. So we were actually trying to go to this unit, and actually I was setting my sights up for a really big buck. Had gone there scouting, and he didn't care. He just wanted the first buck that wasn't a spike. So he shot the first buck, in the first 10 minutes of the hunt. And then hunted that whole rest of the day. Didn't see one that I wanted to shoot. And then the next morning, I went back to where I'd scouted because I had this 165, 170 class buck I wanted to shoot. And he was in a herd with a couple others. And long story short, I ended up shooting him. And when I got up to him, it was a different buck. It was, to say ground shrinkage would be an understatement. But he was still a nice buck. I mean, yeah. I don't want to sound like a snob.
You're talking about the buck we just posted?
The 140?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a 3x4, nice velvet buck. But
he's beautiful. Beautiful,
he's about, really. He's about 30 inches smaller than what I was. You know, and I'm not a numbers guy, but with this tag, I was kind of being a numbers guy. So I don't know. It was a great buck. I'm super happy. He's already in the freezer. I already ate some of them on our last elk hunt. And just beautiful buck. And when you see a smaller body buck, you know, a decent rack looks bigger than it really is. So
yeah, story of my life.
You know, lesson learned.
Yeah.
But so it was a great hunt, man.
You're out in you're in Eastern Oregon. Is that where you live? Is that where you're from?
No, I live over about an hour and a half from the coast in Roseburg, Oregon. And so we hunt blacktails, elk, bear, whatever you want over here. We actually have whitetail over here, too. It's a subspecies of your guys' whitetail. It's called the Colombian whitetail.
Oh, yeah.
And they're about 100, 125. If you get a big one, it's 150 pounds.
Okay.
And a really, really good size Colombian whitetail rack is, 120 would be a pig.
Okay.
120 inches. So
similar to like a coos deer.
Yeah, pretty similar to those. Yeah,
they're real dark, right? They're like more of a darker antler.
They vary. Okay. They look just like a whitetail rack, but just mini, a lot smaller. We do have eastern whitetails over in the far reaches of Oregon, but I haven't got a shot at one of those yet.
And you have blacktail too, right?
Yeah, that's what I grew up hunting. And that's I kind of take them for granted because not a lot of guys, hardly anybody, killed a blacktail unless you live where they're at. So
right.
we're kind of treated here. We got Colombian whitetail, blacktail, mule deer, two species of elk, black bear. We got some moose that travel in that we can't hunt yet. We got wolves that we can't hunt yet. So we have tons of big game here.
What is it? Something like you guys have like 11 huntable species of big game, right?
I would, I haven't counted them, but I imagine there's probably pretty close to 11. Yeah.
You just gave
me count them.
The only reason I'm pulling that number is the guys from Pacific Giants, Ray Kosadar and Ray Werdinger from Pacific Crest Archery. I think Ray Werdinger, he might have harvested all 11, or he might have like every one with the bow or something. And I was just talking to Ray Kosador, and I'm just blown away by what you guys got in Oregon. You would never guess it.
You got to be good, number one. That guy sounds like if you're doing it with the bow, he's probably pretty good. And then number two, you have to be super duper lottery lucky. I mean, because it's a once in a lifetime tag. So, it took me 13 years to finally get a tag for antelope. And I killed a 13 and a quarter inch buck. Well, just anywhere else that would be a dink.
Right.
But, Oregon's not known for its antelope, but we have a lot of opportunity. It's an opportunity state more than a quality state.
Yeah, that's, I would love an antelope in Michigan.
You're giving Jimmy a little chubby right now.
We've got mostly just deer and turkey. We got some bears up north that I'm putting in points for, but.
Yep.
And moose, I'm told. Okay. We have a few elk, but, I think that's like a once in a lifetime hunt. I think I'm 3 points in right now, so I've got some time to go.
About 15 or so.
Yeah.
We got those tags over here, man. My buddy's wife drew I call it a once in a lifetime tag because I don't know if you guys have point creep over there, but it's a 17 point tag right now, and she drew it with 6 points. And I went over there and was calling and filming and stuff. And long story short, we didn't get one, and then so they're actually back over there right now. He called me today, and he's like, "We're in them. We just got to get one to stand still." They were within bow range for about 3 hours today, and it was so brushy, just didn't get a shot.
So, do you
speaking of the brush?
What was that?
Speaking of the brush,
yeah,
Oregon, highly varied terrain from one side to the other, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're talking that's over in the far reaches of Northeast Oregon. You can still find super brushy stuff over there, but we've got high desert. We've got really high, where I elk hunt, it's near 8,000 feet. And then over at the Coast Range, I shot that bull this year at 18 yards, and I was on him for two hours. So
like a rainforest, like a jungle.
It's legit rainforest over at the coast. Yeah. Yeah, it's hardcore.
So you wear ASAT from one side to the other?
I do. ASAT's my favorite pattern. I grew up hunting in ASAT camo, and I grew up hunting in Predator camo, and it was one of those two. You're going to use one of those. And then, there's other brands of camo that I like because of the material, but I just am so partial to the ASAT pattern that I just love it, man. I mean, it's just hard. Once you find something that you like and that it works, it's just hard to move away
partial.
From it.
I'm a little partial to it too.
We know that already.
It is. I mean,
that's the pot calling the kettle black over there, fanboy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I'm really more about material than I am about the and some camo guys may disagree with this. I may rub Joe the wrong way on this one, but I really do think that camo nowadays, the newer camos that you have out there are more about the consumer and less about the animal. And
yes,
what do I mean by that? What shit looks cool?
Exactly. You're really right on, cool. Garrett, right on.
Yeah. So it's about breaking up your outline. It's about, number one, it's about hunting and confidence. So if you like that stuff that looks really cool and you're hunting and you're confident, then great. But if you don't like the way that I look with my ASAT or my Predator camo or whatever, because you look like a really big dork out in public wearing that stuff. If you have to go get some arrows or a box of bullets or something, you walk around and that stuff, you're getting some funny looks, man.
I wear mine to church. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Well, I got to live where you live then, because I'm getting some funny looks, Ryan.
Door, Michigan. It's the
But you're right, Garrett. You're absolutely right. I mean, ASAT, Predator, these were not designed for the consumer's eyes, neither of them. And I mean, ASAT, it's never changed. It's not going to change. We all know, I've said it before on here, and it's not to attract a person's eye. It's just, that's not how it's designed.
Yeah. And what's crazy about it is that it's such a simple pattern. I mean, you see a lot of things like Realtree and some of those others that are just extremely complicated, and the farther away you get, and it's just like, well, that's pretty much gray or a green shirt from a far ways away. But with these more simple patterns like ASAT, the farther away you get, you're like, you actually kind of disappear more because you don't blob up so much.
Yeah, yes. That's well put. I was hunting over east last weekend. One of my buddies still had a bow tag, and we were calling, and then we heard these couple cow calls, and then it was just So we snuck our way in there, and long story short, ended up being another hunter, and it was just a guy like in kind of like tucked in the brush, and it just looked like a blob. And then immediately, like, I picked him out, and I'm like, man, you know, like, an elk, would an elk do that? It really depends, but, you know, he's going to have a harder time if he had some solid lines to break that up, you know? I mean, it really does help when you have, it's just really all about breaking up your outline. That's the biggest thing, me personally, and then staying away from the colors that they do see, like the blues and stuff like that, and or whatever they say, the ultraviolets or whatever you want to call them. But, I've thought that for a while about color patterns. Like, man, some of these things are just getting a little gimmicky.
yeah, exactly. And actually, so I have some more questions about the way that you choose gear and stuff, Garrett, but maybe before we get into that, you want to give us a little bit of history, background, bio about who you are, where you come from, and kind of how you got to be who you are right now.
Sure, man. I grew up in Oregon. I'm 28, been hunting here my whole life, and I started bow hunting because for a few reasons. I was still in high school when I picked up a bow. So long story short, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I started bow hunting, rifle hunting over here. I grew up with shoot it, you know, like, what are you doing? Shoot. And it's just target pressure, target panic. And so it was like, get the shot off and we'll find it. Yeah. And so I just would fall apart with a gun. And long story short, it was, having said that, I know it sounds contradicting, but with a rifle, it was just too easy. And, you know, it was, I would spend almost every day out in the woods, and then you give me a 90-degree day, middle of the day, I could still go out and find one and kill one. I mean, it was just that easy with a gun. And then if you brought guys that could actually shoot accurately, it was really easy.
Right.
So, you know, I through all that learning and through being a horrible offhand shot with a gun, I had to get really good at getting more opportunities, being really persistent, really consistent, because it might take me a few opportunities to actually find one that I spotted and he's going to stand there and I can set up on him. And then I'm like, this isn't really doing it for me anymore. So I started getting into the bows, learned literally, had a 5-minute crash course on how to stand and how to anchor. And that was all. And for about 2 years, I struggled.
Yep.
I killed deer, got an elk tag, never killed an elk. And I just killed actually my first bull with a bow this year.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Yeah. I mean, it took me, seven or eight years to finally do it, not for a lack of not getting opportunities, but just giving shots away. I missed a few shots, but it makes me such a better hunter. It just makes you such a better hunter, having to get that more close, more intimate feeling with that animal, just getting within that bow range. It's just not the same thing as shooting him at 400 yards. It just really isn't.
Right.
And that's not a slight against anybody that bow hunts. But long story short, what really turned me into what I am today, and that's where I'm really deep into the bows and bow hunting tutorials and helping people, is I missed a bull that I had spent, you know, 4 years trying to kill. And long story short, it was a D-loop. I blame it on myself because I wasn't on top of my gear. But it was an equipment malfunction because I didn't know what I was really doing with my bow and stuff. My serving was coming apart, my D-loop, the bottom part of it.
Yep.
Sliding down. And then so about every 15 shots, I would sell one about 2 feet high, like 30 yards.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure it out because I had no idea. So I ended up missing a 280, 285 inch, 5-point, big dark horned ivory tipped antlered bull. Just everything I had been wanting for years since I started picking up a bow. And long story short, figured it out when I got back to camp, and I said, never a freaking again am I ever, ever going to have an equipment malfunction cost me, or me not knowing how to do something cost me an animal. And that's the straw that broke the camel's back, man. So I started digging into it, started working on my friend's bows, just absolutely became a sponge, dug head first into it, and then literally did all my own testing and everything, and just learned it pretty much all on my own through trial and error, reading, you know, researching. It's just a really cool adventure. And now, since I went through that struggle, I wanted to help other guys with their learning curve, and started a YouTube channel. Got like over 100 videos on there now of how to's, gear reviews, nice. Shooting tips, stuff like that, you know, how to know if you're going to hit a branch before you hit it kind of thing.
Ooh, Jimmy, you should watch that one.
Yeah. I'm deadly.
You got to watch out for those trees, man. They do move.
Yeah, they're loud. They really come out of nowhere. One too. Yeah.
Yeah. I've hit one or two, you know, throughout, but you know, you start getting rid of all these errors in the preseason or right. in the off season, if you have an off season and you have this time to prepare, you need to get rid of all these errors then instead of during the season. Let's have those learning curves before we go on our hunt rather than during the hunt. And since then, I don't eat deer tags. I grew up hunting deer, and I sound me sound a cocky douche, but I don't eat deer tags.
Right.
I get it done with the deer. Elk has been a huge struggle for me because I didn't grow up doing it. And even though I lived here, you know, we did it with guns. And the bow hunting has been the most rewarding for elk, period. I mean, you can't beat it. I went to Africa this year, shot some stuff over there, and it's a tenth as cool as shooting a bull with your bow. It's not even the same level, dude. Not even. Maybe I haven't hunted moose and stuff yet, but you can't beat a bull elk screaming in your face. You can't. I don't think you can do it.
Is it just the challenge mixed with the size and the noise, or what puts elk over the top?
Have you ever had one bugle at you at like 20 yards?
No, I tell these guys last year I went for the first time. I didn't hear a bugle. I saw finally on the last day of a 5-day hunt is when I saw my first elk 3 miles away. So,
It took me over 2 years, and there's a huge story to all of this, but I don't want to spend the whole time telling that story. But there's a huge story to all this. It took me 2 years to hear my first bugle, and I was running around in the woods by myself with the Primo's Blue Reed, and yep. that's the Terminator bugle. And I called in a lot of bulls with that thing. Guys can make fun of that thing, but it does work.
I have that. I have one. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you can pick them out in the woods, but you know, I called in so many bulls with those things, and then I'd blow opportunity. But the reason I ask, if you haven't had a bull bugle at you at close range and you haven't had that feeling that it just pierces your body, like that bugle just goes right through you. And it's just, I don't know. It's got to be trying to describe the 50-yard line at the Super Bowl. I mean, right. unless you're there, you're not going to get it. So
what did you learn? What did you learn this year? What set this year apart from last year, the year before, and what you know, in terms of knowing what to do?
That's a great question. Well, podcast and you know, 7 or 8 years of failure, and you know, my track record probably shows that I'm a really shitty elk hunter. But truth be told, we do put elk on the ground. This year, my buddy ended up getting one right in the shoulder at 27 yards. It took us 4 hours to get that one, and then we never got him. You know, shoulder shot with that one, but 4 hours worth of
hunting. Was that the one where you just posted a picture of the shaft that broke at the head?
Oh, I saw that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know,
how much penetration did he get?
4 inches, yeah. Maybe. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, that's not even enough to. Yeah, that elk ran away. That elk was running away, probably still thinking about cows when he left. So, I mean, elk shoulders are tough, man, and you can build the ultimate arrow, and you can still not get through. And if you do get through, I would chalk it up to you're shooting a really heavy arrow and you're shooting the right broadhead and you still got lucky. And that's my opinion. I've seen all the arrow setups and I've seen all sorts of setups hitting the wrong spots. Just hitting them in the right spot prevents a lot of that.
Yep. Hey, but pain retains, lessons learned.
But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, I just want to kind of ask what's your setup? What do you got rolling?
Oh, my setup. Well, I didn't answer the first question, but the first question, it was about 7 years worth of failures and the learning from those, and then podcasts and stuff. That's how that happened, and then just sticking with it. But the next question was what was my setup?
Yeah.
Or is my setup? I shoot a Hoyt RX1 turbo. I'm a smaller guy, so I have a 28 inch draw. I shoot my 457 grain 340 spine 5mm axis at 282 feet per second, and I have 80% mods on my Hoyt instead of the 85.
A little more speed out of that.
I do. You know, my shoulder wishes I would have went with the 85s, but I like that extra speed.
I feel that. No, Jared and I, we switched to trad.
Oh.
So my shoulder, I know the let off. I miss a little bit of let off now. I've been shooting on this afternoon, and like after a while, it's like feeling that.
I know exactly why my shoulder hurts, and it was not last year, but the year prior to that. I was in the zone into becoming the best shot I could be. I was making YouTube videos. I was shooting. I was tracking my group, where I'd fall off, you know, how many arrows into the day I'd fall off, what my average groups were at every range. I had charts. I was charting it. I shot about, and I quit charting it later towards the season, but I shot about 20,000 arrows between January 24th and the beginning of September. And that's what did it to my shoulder. I was shooting a Halon 6 and yep. just shooting 200, 250 shots a day. It was, yeah. I mean, I'd go home and I'd lay awake because my shoulder would be killing me, and then I'd go do it again the next day.
So was this fun to you, or was this just training?
It's fun to get good. It's really, you're not going to do something that much if it sucks. I mean, if you really don't like it, you're not going to do something that much. I love shooting a bow. I love seeing what this broadhead did. Why did it do that? Why did this vein do that? Why did this arrow do that? You know, why did the wind affect it in this way versus that way? Or how far can I shoot? You know, a couple of years ago, I tried breaking the world record
for the longest
bow shot. Yeah. And, you know, I went for it when I shouldn't have. I should have called off the shot, but I went for it. And long story short, the record is with the guy that it should be with. I think he's impacting more people than if I actually took the record. So
what was that guy's name?
What is the record?
Matt Sussman. I think it's 310 yards currently.
Did he hit it right in the 10 ring, or he just hit the target?
No, it's a 42-inch field target. I might have one. Yeah, I've got one right here. It's 42 inches. It stands about that tall, and it's huge. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with the size of target that you get. I think it should be Archer's MOA. So if you shoot 300 right. yards, it should be a 30-inch target. It's a big target, man. And my last arrow was about a foot off of it. So, but you know, he's a one-armed guy, or he has no arms, and he still goes out there, shoots a bow, does everything, takes care of himself, has a wife and kids, I believe. And I think that guy having the record is going to be more impactful than a guy that like me breaking the record and not, you know, it's just, I'd rather have him have the record anyways. I'm kind of glad I did.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Good for him.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And yeah, he's an awesome guy. You know, I hope he keeps pushing the limits, man, because you can go a lot farther. I've seen guys shoot over 400 yards and put it on target. So
hey, that 42 inches looks really small at 400 yards.
Yeah, I'll tell you, when you're shooting that far away, I was trying all sorts of different things. I was trying to peep up pretty much below my cam so I could try and anchor like that. And then, you know, that wasn't really working out very well. And then so I started using finer tip points where they kind of came to a more tip, like a broadhead. And then I would actually use my peep and my broadhead and or my field point, and I aim up at a mountain. And there's a few things that you can do to really make it easier on yourself. You have to have something behind the target that's really high, like a mountain or a tree, to aim at.
Sure.
In order to, yeah. So I
like
was
a reference point.
I was literally aiming at the top of a huge hill, and then actually happened to aim about at the treetops on top of that hill, and it was crazy. I mean, it was fun, but I don't ever plan on trying to do it again.
So you're taking it easier on your shoulder these days.
I've only shot about 5,000 or 6,000 arrows this year, and I still have to take days off. It hurts right now. And, you know, I've been going back to the gym, and I've been working on trying to get, you know, I got an AccuBow and everything. It's a problem. I see, so, you know, shoulder surgery in my future coming up, but I don't know.
So is one day, or me and Jared are going to see you on Instagram shooting a crossbow at some point when you blow out your shoulder completely?
A crossbow? No. actually, I have some projects coming up that, because I want to start moving into the excuse eliminator kind of mindset, because I have some friends that shot with a mouth tab this year.
Oh, sure.
One was in a serious accident, and like when I gave him a hug, like his whole side of his body was just gone. It was like mangled, and he's still out there bow hunting, man. So, you know, John Dudley's done it.
I've seen him. Yep.
Josh Keller from Shooting the Bull podcast has done it. You've got Courtney Levesque here in Eugene. She's done it. I'm going to do it just for fun, I think, just to teach people. And no one has really got a good way to actually get a good, consistent anchor point with it. Accuracy for some folks, has been kind of a problem with the mouth tab because your face and your nose is too far from the string. So I'm going to try and come up with some sort of methodology or shot sequence that somebody can really be accurate out to, you know, 50, 60, 70 yards with a mouth tab. So,
something repeatable. And
so I guess
it's
for maybe
consistent.
So I guess maybe for some of the listeners that might not know what a mouth tab is, Can you explain just a little bit
about what that is? Yeah, so let's assume that I did have a shoulder surgery. So I have one arm that I can shoot a bow with. Let's say I'm right-handed and I shoot a right-handed bow. So I'm going to have my right shoulder is going to be bad. So now I can't draw my bow. Well, with the mouth tab, some guys use a dog leash and they cut it off and they attach it to their D-loop. And so they bite down on like this little pad and like it can be like a dog leash just cut off. And they push their bow out from them. They draw their bow with their neck muscles and their head. And that's how they shoot. They release it with their teeth.
I feel like that would rip my teeth.
I know.
Right,
that's
out.
Ridiculous. What kind of draw weight are they using?
Oh, 50. 55. Wow. Yeah, I think if a guy had a nice smooth drawing bow, maybe like a HTX or an HTR, you could probably get 65. So I'm gonna figure it out, man. I think a really the key to that would be to have a really long axle draw length. Maybe like Halon X or something. Try something like that, and then
real smooth.
I'm gonna figure it out. It's gonna help people and people that think that they can't go bunting. I've also got another project I want to start doing where I'm a gear guy. I forgot to say that in the intro, but I love gear. I love doing gear reviews and helping people figure out what's best for them. But I'm gonna maybe go the opposite approach next year and start going cheap.
Okay.
So you don't have to have a $1,600 bow. You don't have to have $400 boots. You don't have to have a $350 sight. You don't have to have all this crap to go out and kill stuff. And I don't want to be the guy that makes people think that. So, right. So I may go out with a Diamond Infinite Edge or something next year.
Yep.
And just get it done with the Whisker Biscuit and just put things to rest, man. I mean, my buddy kills more stuff in blue jeans and whatever t-shirt he has on that day than a lot of guys I know. And, it's just actually getting out there. And buying tags instead of gear, like the born and raised guys say, I totally agree with that. So I am a gear guy, but I also don't want to influence people away from bow hunting because they don't think they can afford it.
So a new guy, this is actually good. My next question was going to be about, say I'm a new guy to archery
yeah.
hunting. What do where do I start? I mean, do I just go to the On Point YouTube channel and watch your videos? What do I do? Say I know nothing about archery. How do I go about becoming proficient?
Well, I get that question a lot, man. And that's a good question. So the thing that I would say is where's the closest pro shop? I'm not talking about a Cabela's.
Right.
I'm not talking about Dick's Sporting Goods or Walmart. Where's the closest pro shop that you have near you? And I've been talking to a lot of guys from over east, and it just sounds like there's a little bit of difference between our pro shops and pro shops over there on the tuning aspect. over there, mechanicals just became approved this week for 2019 in Oregon.
I saw that. That's amazing.
Yeah. So, we might be moving in that direction, and I'm not bashing guys that have bow shops over east, but I hear that the amount of time that they spend on tuning isn't equal to guys that have to tune fixed broadheads over here at the shops. And that's coming from guys over in like Kentucky. So go to the closest pro shop you have, shoot all the bows, shoot them all. Don't care about what brand it is. Start from the bottom, work your way up. I don't care. And really, you can buy the nicest one you can afford, but I'd rather have better accessories than a better bow. You can have a cheap, cheap, cheap sight, have that thing come out of alignment way easier than a Spot Hog. I used Spot Hog tab for years, and I used to have to sight in my bow all the time when I had a cheap, cheap sight. I set this once, and I'm done. I drag it, hit it against rocks, throw up my pack, throw up my truck. Doesn't ever come out of alignment. So I'd rather have a decent bow and nicer accessories than a really nice bow and the world's crappiest bow sight and stuff.
Well, those
like that.
Those Spot Hogs, I mean, we had a buddy, they're tough as nails. He had one, he was trying to shoot at like 150 yards or mm-hmm. something. So he's dialing, he had the Hog Father, he's dialing it down and not realizing that he dialed it too low and literally shot his own sight. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it popped it up, but he popped it right back down and it was fine. It was unbelievable that he literally shot it point blank. And he wanted forever to do a video of himself hammering a nail in with his with his Hog Father. I mean, it's not a cheap sight, but I mean, you could run that thing over and it's going to be fine.
No, I was actually talking to the owner the other day, and they're pretty backordered. So if you have a sight that you want, they're about six to 7 weeks out.
Okay.
But You can buy them. I don't know about over there, but over here you can buy them off the shelf. It may not be the one you want, but you can get one pretty darn close to the one you want. So, but you know, for someone that's brand new getting into the sport, straight up, go to the pro shop, shoot all the bows. Don't listen to the guys that already are biased. You know, there's some very cultish followings for some of these brands, and I don't understand. If you love boning so much, why wouldn't you want to shoot all the bows? I mean, I just don't understand this cultish following that some of these manufacturers have, but that's beside the point. So go shoot all the bows, learn what your draw length is, learn how to stand, learn how to grip the bow, do all these things. And yeah, I do have a YouTube channel for that. I show a lot of really basic stuff on there. There's some other stuff that are more technical that a lot of guys that maybe have been hunting for a few years don't know. There's stuff that I've had guys that have been bow hunting their whole lives, and I'm like, dude, yeah, cool, awesome. I had no idea. And
right.
And then, like, I got messages the other day from a local guy, been bow hunting for 7 years, having some weird flight after 60, 70 yards with broadheads. I mean, he was shooting perfect after 60, 70 yards, and then it was just falling off. And so I sent him a couple of videos that I thought would fix it. And then he sent me a picture yesterday, was it 2 days ago, with a bull, and said, shot this thing at, you know, 60 yards, and my arrows were flying great. Thanks for the video. You know, just
nice.
That kind of stuff. So there's little things that you can do. It's not going to be one thing. You got to look at archery like a puzzle, and you just got to start putting the pieces in the puzzle, and then you're going to get the bigger picture someday, and then you're going to figure it out. And I also, this is the one thing that I tell people getting into archery, and I drill this every time, is you got to look, because you're going to get people's different opinions, right? You can have Joe over there saying, you got to shoot like this. This is how you do it. And then you're going to have me saying, well, I do it like this. Well, if you look at shooting like a racetrack, you're going to have multiple lanes on that track. Joe may be in this lane. I may be in this lane. You got to find out what lane you are in and then run it. You know, that is going to be what's best for you. There's certain principles at archery, and you guys know this, but for the new guy out there, you know, if your shot process, you're going to hear me say that all the time if you watch my videos and listen to the podcast, but the shot process must be duplicatable and it must be consistent. You can have the world's crappiest form and everything, but if you are duplicatable and you are consistent, you will be accurate. You know, you could have a string that far off your nose. I don't know if you guys can see me, but you can have a string an inch off your nose. You can be an inch too far long on your draw and have your string past your nose. But if you're duplicatable and you're consistent, you're going to have accuracy, because that's what accuracy is, right? It's just doing the same thing over and over again. And if you're not having tuning issues and stuff like that, yeah, that arrow is going to go very similar to that last arrow if you do the same thing over and over again. So, I mean, there are some things to gain accuracy, hand placement, you know, pushing and pulling versus punching the trigger, target yep. panic, you know, there's some things, some basic foundational principles that guys need, right? Like punching the trigger harder than Mike Tyson isn't a good foundational principle. I think that doesn't matter what lane you're in, punching the crap out of your trigger is not good. And 90, I'd say, you know, when I go to bow shoots, I'm sure you guys see it too, guys using caliper releases or wrist rockets, and 99% of them are target panic. They all have target panic, and whether they want to admit it or not, it's kind of a pride thing with a lot of guys. I fight it all the time. Target panic is, I think it honestly, it affects 99% of folks out there.
Like that you're saying the word, because then I think about it.
James, you had a little bit of target panic.
I was, for a while, I was shooting
it
great.
It was really messing you up.
And I went literally from the best I had ever shot to... I mean, sometimes I could hardly keep it on the target, where I could not get my pin on, I would hold it high most of the time, and I could not bring it down. My brain wouldn't, I don't know why.
Yep. We went to that 3D shoot.
Yeah, and I just, north, and I you just could not. And it was shoot. Like, you know, you're depressed, you hate yourself a little bit, you know.
You know, mine is, I like my buddy Team Dirty Trad, he hangs hot above the bullseye. When I get it, I hang low. Okay. Some guys just hang, you know, I don't know how deep you want to get into target panic, but I've written articles on it. I think I've even done a YouTube video on it. Maybe I haven't. I'm not sure. I've done a lot of videos and a lot of stuff. So sometimes I forget, but
right.
I know I've written an article on how to beat target panic. And what it is, if you really want to get the actual definition, it is a mental disorder. Is really what it is.
It's not my first one.
Brain. Yeah. Right. Mine either. You can ask my wife.
Yeah.
But it is a mental disorder where your brain is anticipating the bow going off and the pin being on the bullseye. And so I've got a lot of names for it. A lot of guys you'll see, I don't know if you guys can see me on the video, but they'll be going like this, and then you'll see them come across and punch it. And that's, you know, I call that drive-by shooting or fly-by-night shooting or whatever you want to call it. That's target panic. I mean, you see that every day you go to the range. And like I said, over 9 out of 10 times, they're going to be doing that. And so starting off with good foundational principles from the beginning, because I learned how to shoot like that. I learned how to just punch the crap out of the trigger. Yep. Just so about 7 years into hunting, you know, I'm trying to become the best archer I can be. I'm on this tear of just being the best bow hunter I can be. And I get a hold of a guy that, you know, used to be a national champion, or triple crown winner and stuff. And he's like, "You're a pretty good shot, but do you have your off days?" I'm like, "Yeah, everybody has their off days." He's like, "I do too, but you know the difference between me and you." I'm like, "No, what is it?" He's like, "Your off days look like a basketball. Mine look like a playing card." I was like, "Okay, why is that?" He's like, "Because you're doing this, what I just described, that fly-by-night shooting. What I'm doing is I'm holding on target and I'm waiting for my bow to go off."
Yeah.
And so my amount of error is how much is my pin floating. Yours is mental error and physical. Because when you expect that shot, you get that jerk, that twitch, that twitch in your muscles, and that's what sends that arrow over there. So and here's a good way to describe it. Can you guys see what I'm doing?
I can't. Nope.
Okay. I can't either.
But you're painting a verbal picture right now. Mm-hmm. So. Okay.
So if you picture your pin floating over a big bullseye, and it's just floating around doing figure eights and going sideways and doing stuff like this, mm-hmm. and then you shoot 6 inches to the right, well, what happened there? What the heck happened? Because your pin all of a sudden just didn't go zoom and then head back to the bullseye. What happened there is that your muscles twitched and you pulled that thing over. I mean, that is so common in archery, and no one wants to talk about it because it's a pride thing. I don't get it, man. I really don't. I work on target panic every week minimum. I work on target panic. I work on preventing it, shooting 2 to 3 yards away from the target. I work on my release. I bought a hinge release, which I think was the best move I ever did. You know, you got to start with good foundational principles. And I know I kind of got on a tear from a rabbit hole here, but you know, if you're getting into bow hunting, you need to learn from somebody that's doing it correctly, because you don't want to build bad habits. And that's probably where I was going with that.
So it's the surprise. It seems like this almost, you hold it there and then you're pulling. And so you're using a hinge, which if, you know, for those that don't know what a hinge release is, you want to just say, you know, describe it.
Yeah. So a hinge is a handheld release. So not the ones that go over your wrist and strap on and then have a trigger. So a handheld release is one that you hold in your hand. There's three different styles. You got back tension, you've got hinge, and then you've got the thumb style. The thumb style still has a trigger that you can punch. I'm not a really big fan of those. It's just too tempting for guys. If you're going to do it, I would go with just because I have more experience with a hinge, I'd go with the hinge. Because what it is basically you have a release that once it rotates, instead of relying on force, it has this rotation. And once you hit that rotation, it goes off. So when you are at full draw and you have your arm out, I'm at full draw right now. And what you're going to do is you're going to act like you're trying to pinch like a pencil with your shoulder blades. Like someone just poked you right in the spine between your shoulder blades. And it was like, gave you that funny feeling. And like it gave you that chill right there in your spine. You're going to try and pinch that spot, and you're going to bring your elbow back slightly, and that bringing your elbow back is going to change the angle on that hinge release, and that's what's going to make it go off.
Yep.
You know, some guys use their hand. I started off using the hinge and using my hand to make it go off. I would relax my index finger, and that would rotate the release around my middle finger, and it would rotate that way. But that would basically change where my peep was, and I would have to keep – I would struggle with my anchor that way. You can get a better anchor if you just use your elbow, long story short. So that's a hinge release. You know, do you have to have one of those to start off? Heck no. I have a video on how to use a release, a caliper release, and there's a reason I use my whole hand instead of just a finger. And I learned this from another very, very successful archer. He's like, when from day one as a baby, you're grabbing things, right? You're grabbing things with not just a finger, but with your whole hand. So it's natural for you to want to grab things. But when you have one little twitchy finger, it's just it's just way, way, way too twitchy. I mean, you gotta, if you use your whole hand, you're relying on more, and it's slower. It's more methodical. You can control right. that whole hand more than just that finger. So why not just slowly make a fist and then bring that elbow around like you would a hinge, slowly make a fist, and then wait for that thing to go off, because you can get a surprise release with a trigger or a caliper release. You can't. It is hard. It is not easy, and it takes shooting all the time.
Yep.
Get that, you know, but
and punching yourself in the face a few times, which I've seen many guys do with some of those hinge and back tension.
Those back tension releases are just way too much for me.
Yeah, not really.
Oh yeah, I can't handle it. We tried that one at the range.
You didn't like that?
I did not like that.
There's different safeties that they have where you can let go of it, so you're not worrying about punching yourself so much.
All right, I can understand, you know, pull through the shot.
Yeah.
But I just...
You're a thumb...
I'm a thumb guy.
Well, yeah, for compound.
Yeah. But not anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the trick to using... I learned how to use mine, and I was pretty damn good with it inside of a week. I shot about 300 shots with it on my Acibo. So if I did have a misfire, there was no harm, no foul.
Right.
And I did. I had 5 or 6 where I was like, oh, shit. You know, like, oh, it just went off when I was, you know, half drawn. And so... I got all the kinks out on my Acibo, and then I started shooting it at 10 yards in the range. And after a week, I was shooting, you know, 290s with my hunting bow, Vegas based. So it's very doable if you do it the right way. You have to have somebody teach you how to use this thing in person. Do yourself a favor. First time I ever tried one, my buddy's like, try this thing. And he's got a half cocked smile, and he's just waiting for me to punch myself. And he's like, it's a back tension. You just got to wait for it to go up. And that's all the information I got. I'm like, all right. So I pull back, and I'm like, back tension, back tension. So I start pulling harder and harder. I'm like, and I think I said something like, oh, God. I was shooting at 20, and I sent it like over the 80 towards the house. It's like, oh, God, you know, like, watch out, world. Here comes this, that one. But and I never shot a. Never shot that release again, and that almost ruined it for me. I didn't touch one for another year. So it's just, you got to learn from the right way, from the right person. And I've taught a few buddies how to do it. They don't like them, but they never had a misfire. And they shot, you know, it's just learning from somebody that has done it successfully. The guys that you see punching themselves are probably ones that their buddies are doing that same shit to them, you know, they're just waiting.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, are you alive over there still?
I'm here. All right. I'm just soaking it all in.
All right. Hey, Joe, what kind of release do you shoot?
Myself. Yeah. I'm switching between the True Fire caliper and the Spot Hog caliper, both wrists.
The wise guy?
The wise guy.
Yeah. Yep. That's sweet.
There's not a ton of so I've been shooting True Fire for so long, and I'm at a loss for which actual model I'm shooting. I'm shooting their top of the line model, and there's a lot of flexibility in the between the head and how it rotates.
Yep.
It rotates on a bunch of different axes, and the Spot Hog doesn't have as much rotation or as much flexibility in it. And I was having trouble getting used to it with changing my setup to new breed and changing bows, changing arrows. I mean, I completely revamped my setup going into this fall on really, really short notice. And the only reason I was able to do it was, like Garrett's saying, fundamentals. That's how you build that basis of fundamentals, and you can switch between bows and different equipment, not with ease, but relative ease.
Yeah. What kind of wrist strap are you using? Are you using the stock ones? You guys switched to the boas yet?
I'm running a stock on the True Fire, and I've got that thing so stretched, it's finally quit stretching. And I'm down to like the third hole, and I've got beefy wrists, but I'm all the way down to the third hole on the True Fire. The boa, I have the boa on the wise guy, and I was actually having a lot. I have stout wrists, but they're bony as well. And the boa was eating my wrists up.
Really?
It was the, you know, they have the two cords, and as you put them together, they were like, the one sat perfect on my wrist bone where I liked it. And I'll get used to it. I'm going to play with it more in the off season, going into next fall, because I love the repeatability of that release. Yep.
It is sweet.
Truly repeatable.
Yep.
And it's got that heavy brass trigger, the heavy brass trigger and the heavy brass D-loop catch.
Yeah.
They feel so good when you get a true surprise release. It's, it just deadens everything, I guess you could say.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I actually got from Iboa, I've got a huge quarter size callus on the bottom part of my like palm as it hits my wrist. And yep. So, but yeah, I'm never going back. Yeah.
Are you still shooting a wrist rocket?
Yeah. I almost hunted with my hinge this year, man. I really wanted to. And then I'm like, you know, just not there yet. So I've been shooting a short and sweet for 4 or 5 years, and I got like 3 of them I keep. And the reason I shoot those ones, and you touched on it a second ago, and here's for somebody starting off, if you're buying a release, usually you won't hear me say don't buy this, but don't buy this. Don't buy the release that has a bar that you cannot adjust the length of pull between the wrist strap and the actual trigger mechanism.
I had one of those.
Thanks for telling me now.
I love seeing the pictures or watching the videos with the people shooting with their fingertips.
Yep.
And most of those are unadjustable bar style caliper.
Yeah.
Right. You're gripping whatever you can reach.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, I shot a Cobra wrist rocket.
Same here. Yep. I still have it.
And I'll tell you what, I shot with the tip of my pinky finger. Now, many years later, a lot of firearms training, and now with a lot of archery training and coaching, I realized, like, wow, how I'm glad I was hitting things.
Yeah. Jared, what release are you running this year?
I'm using the old phalanges.
You got finger release.
Oh, yeah.
Are you doing a glove?
I'm rocking a glove. Yep, all leather.
Three finger?
Cool.
Three fingers.
You're not doing the tab.
No, I'm not.
Why?
Because
he wants to outshoot you.
That's never gonna happen.
It happens all the time.
Are you guys going 3 under, or what are you doing?
Jimmy's a 3 under.
Yeah.
I'm a split finger.
That's what
I'm a splitty. You an animal?
No, I just like to be able to hold the arrow in between my finger.
You know, I saw a guy do it with a thumb, like the thumb release. Oh, yeah.
Joel Turner shot IQ.
Joel Turner, yeah. Yeah,
also
yeah.
Shot a mouth guard. It was just in a he's a police officer full time.
Really?
Yeah. It was a scuffle and hurt his shoulder and shot. He was shooting a mouth tab for 3D. And I can't remember what bow he was shooting. He was something crazy like an Oneida or something.
Yeah.
I've got one of those.
Jared shot an Oneida when he was young.
Sitting in my garage right now.
He's a marvel. I mean, he's got the shot process figured out. I talked to him briefly one time on the phone. Just we have relatable subjects to talk about. And we were talking for a little bit. And he's got it figured out. And he shoots that true instinctive.
Yeah.
And I give him credit. I'm not even going to dabble in that field
yet. It takes a lot of shots to get. I mean, there's a lot. It's a lot of trial and error to get to true instinctive. Like the Dan Fitzgerald guy, you know, I don't know if you guys know who that is, but
oh yeah,
he's a Michigan legend.
The red and black plaid guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to get him on this podcast. He hasn't responded to any emails yet. So if you're listening, Dan or Guy, get back to me.
Is he still pumping out video? His videos were awesome.
Oh yeah,
great slaughter videos.
We watch him.
We have the Rutt and Rampage video.
We still watch him at Deer Camp, man. Rutt and Rampage are the dominant doe. Boone and Crockett Spike. I mean, he's got some awesome.
The
hunts.
Man has a wealth of knowledge.
No, so going back to release. No, I'm doing the tab, but I'm doing the 3 under. So Jared, you're split. I just
don't want the tab because that's just one more thing. I have to worry about and to lose.
I agree. You know what I mean? I like the 3 finger that goes around the wrist.
Yep.
My buddy Team Dirty Trad started about a year and a half ago, and the guy is a straight up sniper with that thing out to like 45 yards. He's like hitting these football sized groups out at 45 yards, and at 30 he barely leaves the bullseye.
That's amazing.
It is insane what the brain can do.
It's so I'm at right now, I'm just getting, so my point, so I've got a knock below. And so when I'm, you know, you pull up to the knock once I'm, I think my point on right there is like 22 yards. And so I'm just kind of moving out into the 30 yard range, but that feels like I'm at 120 with the compound. Like it is, I mean, it is, I'm nervous when I'm letting go of the arrow a little bit because I'm not entirely sure, you know. But it is incredible too. One of my favorite things about shooting a bow, any kind of bow, is honestly the moment where you release the arrow and you're seeing it take that arc into the target.
Just watching that.
It's, for some reason, that is addicting to me. And so with the recurve, you get a whole lot more of that arc. So it's just feeding the addiction for me. So at 30 yards, I'm just watching that thing. I'm shooting 50 pounds, and yeah.
Yeah,
but I'm hoping
it's fun, man. Have you got into the tuning aspect of it now? The tiller tuning,
yeah.
And all that stuff.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time. Yeah, you know, I obsess about it, and I'm not kidding. I'll lay in bed at night thinking about it. And then I get like all worked up, and then I'm like, first thing in the morning, I got to go shoot just to get it out.
But you bear shafted your arrow so this time around, didn't you?
Yeah, I bear shaft you. So bear
shafting. What is bear shafting? I guess.
What's that?
I guess for people who don't know, what's bear shafting your arrows?
So, just to rewind, so when you tune a recurve, at least from what I've gathered so far, and I follow a couple guys, the Push, I think I follow those guys, and like the Trad Geeks, they're great. I think they're both out of Pennsylvania too, there, Joe. But from at least the way I did it is, instead of tuning the bow, you tune the, because there's no rest really to tune, you tune your arrow to get the most true flight. So you're essentially adding or taking away weight from the front or the back. And so you start essentially with a bear shaft, and you're shooting that thing, and you're slowly cutting it down or adding weight to the front based on if it's kicking out left or kicking out right. And the way that I did it was, I think this is right, I almost got it dead on bear shaft where maybe it's kicking a little bit, but I figured the weight of the fletching will actually bring it true once I've got the fletching added on. So I spent quite a bit of time. We, you know, like you said, some of the shops, at least out east, aren't great. I have been fortunate enough to find a really, really good one out here, Long Range.
I was gonna say, that's Long Range.
Fantastic. And so they, you know, Dylan, actually, if you ever listen to this, call it. Shout out to Dylan. He spent a lot of time with me, very patiently helping me with that and kind of teaching me all about it, which is, it's, you know, half the fun of archery is just learning about how it works. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, having a lot of fun.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I don't know that I'll switch back.
Do you think it helped?
Really?
What? Yeah, I you know, I've been asked that several times, and I just don't know. I have a lot more fun practicing. And one thing, going back to the target panic that I've added, that I would recommend for anybody that's doing traditional archery, is a clicker. And I know you make fun of me for it, Jared, but
no.
I mean, it truly, you pull back and you hold on, obviously, and you use your pointer, at least I do, as kind of the point of reference when you're aiming the tip of your arrow.
I just let go
and you hear that click.
I just take my index finger and lock it right in the side of my mouth.
See, my problem is, though, I get tired and I'll bend, you know, because it takes two, three shots and you get more fatigued. At least I do. I'm not burly like you.
Step up your game, brother.
But the clicker has forced me to be very, very consistent. And going back to what you said, I mean, consistency is, that's the most important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, Anthony tried to get me into freaking trad bows, and I was so pumped when I'd hit a hay bale at like 20 yards. it was like starting from square one again, man. And then I was like, you know, I still got a bunch of stuff I want to kill before I start making it harder on myself.
Yeah, I'm going to, you know, say that I'm not going to switch back now, but I haven't hunted. Although I know I did. I did take it out hunting.
You took a squirrel, didn't you?
I got a squirrel.
You did, dude.
Yeah. Second squirrel. Shot. First. Yeah. So I stalked.
It's good
him.
Eating right there.
It's good eating. Yeah, it was the opener on the 15th.
That's so impressive.
Yeah, right. I hit a squirrel.
Yeah, that's a small target.
I lost my last two arrows shooting at a bunny in my backyard.
Did you?
that pesky sucker has eaten all our vegetables.
I know. He's getting cocky about it, too.
Peter Rabbit's going down.
So going back, Garrett, I actually had another question I want to ask, and I think we asked Lee this, too, from Seek Outside. What's the most worthless piece of gear? You're a gear guy. What's one thing people put in their pack?
That one thing you're just like, you know what?
It's not worth it. It's a waste of it. Yeah, he asked me about my elk hunt, and I told him it was my rifle because I didn't ever see any elk. what would you say is the most worthless piece of gear in a pack?
Oh, whew. Man, I've never been asked that question. That's a really good question.
I'm brilliant.
Wow. I might have to.
Yeah, good luck getting him out of the studio tonight.
Let's see, the most worthless piece of gear for elk hunting that I've used.
Or any hunting, just hunting.
Well, I honestly, this is a cop out circle answer, but it's the one that you don't use that you pack all day that you think you're going to use, but you never ever touch it.
Sure.
And if you know what I'm talking about, you know what it is. Mm-hmm. So For me, sometimes that's been like a third extra knife, or sometimes that's been, gosh, you know,
just that extra necessity.
I carried a freaking elk decoy around, a Montana decoy around one time, and then I was like literally trying to find situations where I could use it instead of just hunting, you know. And it was like, I spent like $100 on this bastard, and I'm going to use it. I stick it in the ground and start calling, you know. But
yeah,
did it at least pack up nice?
What was that?
Did it at least pack up nice? Like, were you losing a lot of pack space hauling that thing around?
No. Well, it folds out like a pop up tent almost. Like it just, whew, and then it's up.
Sure.
And so like if you don't have it right in your pack, it'll like try to un-go on itself. So like
I use their turkey decoys exclusively and religiously.
Yeah.
The two dimensional, and now they just came out with the three dimensional, and they all fold flat.
I saw those. Those flat, are sweet.
But they do. They pop out, and like the two dimensional ones are always flat. But yeah, they're like spring loaded. They can we actually like to play games with them when we put them in our pack and don't put the strap on them. So when someone opens the pack, it pops out, and they can be fun.
Actually, I got the product. I had to think about it long enough. It's Scent Killer.
Scent Killer.
Yeah, us Western guys don't use Scent Killer.
Mm-mm. It's pointless.
I'm getting there. It's too much. I don't have enough brain space.
Wait till I talk to your boyfriend.
Yeah, you know,
your Michigan guy. You're gonna really disappoint him.
I know. You know,
I thought you were gonna get full scent lock this year.
it doesn't come in ASAP, man.
Yeah,
oh, that's true.
You could have got the liner suit.
You could have shaved all your hair, got the liner suit, and been scent free.
It's just I obsess about it, and it would bother me knowing that there's no way I am gonna sneeze and I'm gonna have a smell
literally
come out
impossible.
Or so I want to add, I asked this to Lee from Seek Outside, this question, and I didn't have a great one, but I have since come up with one that I've never bought, but I found the most useless. It's called the Cruncher Call. You guys ever heard of this?
Is it like leaves, like crunchy?
No,
leaves?
Close. It's supposed to sound like a deer chewing on an acorn.
Oh, wow.
It's a Hunter Specialties Cruncher Call, and you twist it and it just sounds like someone's grinding up rocks. And,
like when my kid's sleeping and he's grinding his teeth.
Yeah. So that's a thing. You could buy it. I personally, and you know what? Maybe it's worked for somebody and they've shot a big giant buck with
it. Could be a sponsor. Let's
maybe
relax.
It's a sponsor
well,
at some point.
Let's put it this way. If you're close enough for a buck to hear that, why don't you shoot it?
That's right. What are you calling it
Wait,
in for? It's
do you
close
hear
enough.
That buck like a quarter exactly. mile away? He's really chomping on some acorns.
That's right.
Well, you guys, so I feel like I need to justify my answer because a lot of whitetail guys that sit and stand, scent control is probably important for you guys. But for us, we walk, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 miles a day. And after the first half mile, you're sweating. So I mean, honestly, and you're hanging around a campfire. You're doing all sorts of things. Good luck.
I hunt whitetails a lot. Yeah, I hunt whitetails a lot, and I used to be crazy, fanatical, bins, totes, sprays, showers, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Still getting winded. And I completely switched my approach. I do stick with fragrance-free products.
Right.
But I pay attention to the wind, and I hunt smarter than harder. And it's worked out actually better for me. I get winded less just thinking out and thinking through the situation. And I know like the scent killer products on the market, and they dry my skin out, which then your skin will then flake off and different
and then
things.
Smell.
Try having a bald head and washing your head with that thing. You will itch for days.
Yeah.
Well, I got a secret weapon up my sleeve for this fall. So we'll talk about that at a later date. But we're gonna be busting it. We're gonna be busting out the Ozonics this fall. We're gonna give it a crack. Oh. I'm gonna have my 5-year-old with me, so he stinks.
Yeah.
I'm gonna need all the help I can get.
Five-year-old stinks because I've always wondered if that stuff works.
We have to.
It seems like a love-hate relationship. I mean, I got some people I talk to that they just look at me like I got two heads and I'm dumb. And then I got other guys that are like, oh, man, be careful how many people you tell, because
really,
that's the secret weapon right there. And I've been using scent crusher bags, doing like a dry wash on my clothes because I got two kids. I work full-time, and my kids are both involved in sports and extracurriculars. I don't have time to wash my camo. Like sometimes I don't have time to hunt, let alone hunt, then wash all my stuff and deodorize it and do it. So I cheat with the ozone bag, which has worked out well, and just trying to hunt smarter and just mainly just trying to have fun while I'm hunting and not get bogged down by all the nonsense in the products. And I missed the Seek Outside podcast, and that's the first time I heard you ask that question, James. And the most useless stuff in my bag is pretty much everything at the start of the season.
Yeah.
By the end of the season, I'm carrying just the essentials. And I'm real big with turkey hunting with that. Like I'm a giant turkey hunter. And the beginning of the season, I'll be carrying a Kefaru pack. And by the end of the season, I got what's in my pockets, and that's all I really need, which is either my bow, my shotgun, and a handful of mouth calls from Galvis calls. So
seems like guys over where you live really get into that turkey hunt.
Oh,
turkey hunting is
you're
awesome.
You're talking to one that's right here. That's all I live for it. And you know what? It is the equivalent of it's elk hunting.
Really?
But see, I've heard that comparison before.
There's no doubt. I mean, I've never been elk hunting. Next year will be my first year.
Oh, man.
But everybody I've talked to and all the stories I hear, everything I've read about elk, it is the equivalent of shooting it's hunting elk. I mean, you're actually working, you know, a gobbler with a lot of times hens, or he gets lonely and he's by himself. It's all calling strategy, setup strategy. The one cool thing is you don't have to play the wind, but you then are combating a turkey's trichromatic vision.
Yeah.
So where a turkey can't smell.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Turkeys have trichromatic. They can actually see color. And so that was a real big point that I was doing this spring, hunting with the bow. I actually shot a gobbler, running gun style, we call it, where you're on the move, working birds, trying to strike a bird. So you're out and you'll yelp. I do a gobble, trying to get a response from a gobbler. And then you will set up on them. And don't call them to your location and kill them. Now, with a shotgun, I've killed a ton of birds, but there's no movement once he gets in.
You put it on your knee and they come in.
Yep, you're stationary. You can kind of predict. I can actually adjust my calling to change the course of a gobbler on his approach and use decoys as well. But this year I did it with the bow on the ground in ASAT at point blank range. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the 13th gobbler I had within bow range.
Really?
I mean, it gets tough when they get close. I have some video, and we're going to be posting it in the spring. I've had gobblers at spitting distance, and it's then they weren't picking me up until I started moving.
Yeah,
Joe, you shot that Tom this year, like almost in the middle of the field, though.
I was actually that bird was giving me the slip all spring, and I actually was like a combination. We're technically not allowed to stalk birds in PA. So you can't just straight up stalk them. But what I do is I'll push. He had hens with him.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the hens and pushing him to a point where I could get up in front of him and intercept him in the field where I knew there was a low spot. And I was able to get up and none of them saw me. The hens, the gobbler, I was in the middle of a field and they did not see me.
Why can't you stalk a bird in Pennsylvania?
It's for safety. We have, we're the land of a million hunters like Michigan.
Yeah.
And they just don't allow stalking. We actually used to have to wear orange while we were moving. And anytime you were moving between setups, the only time you were allowed to be in full camo was when you were stationary.
Really? It's that bad, huh?
Yeah, man.
It's on public land, it gets interesting.
You make Oregon. We're trying to get them out of our freaking yards and garden. They're nuisances over here.
What turkey? That's not the Eastern turkey. What is that? The Merriam's turkey? Which one is that?
I have no idea. I don't.
They have the white. They have the white tipped tails.
I don't think so.
It's got to be Merriam's.
Young Jamie's looking at that.
Well, young Jamie,
it's got to be the
Merriam's.
Which is a beautiful bird.
Yeah.
I live and breathe for turkey hunting, Garrett. Like,
shoot, dude, so I could get you on so many birds over here just by.
See, I only call with the diaphragm call. I actually, since I've been a child, there's a local guy here. He's like a bit of a legend in our area. His name's Denny Galvis. And I actually would go to his seminars when I was a kid to learn how to turkey hunt and learn how to call. My dad was getting into it real big, and that was in the late 80s. And then I actually went to college with his boy. And I exclusively use his mouth calls. I'm real into the linguistics of the turkey and how to talk to a tom and how to talk to the hens. A lot of times I'll call hens in to shoot a gobbler.
Interesting.
It's a lot like elk hunting. I mean, it's very similar.
Yeah. I've heard that through the Meat Eater podcast, because those guys talk about turkey hunting quite a bit.
Yeah, I listened to that too.
They kind of have these debates about, you know, is it like elk hunting? And then half of them were like, yeah, it is. And the other half were like, no, yeah.
It's similar and different. I mean, you're moving a lot.
It depends on how you do it. It depends on how you do it.
Yeah,
so
exactly. Strategies sound different.
Yes, I'm a running gun hunter. Yeah, I'm a running gunner. I do not like, I shot a bird in a blind on opening day. It was raining. I was filming and I shot him at like 3 yards. It's awesome video. I can't wait to put it out. I was in an ASAP blind I set up the night before. I don't typically like to hunt like that. It worked for that scenario, but I like to move, hunt, I like to locate. I like to scout, locate birds, go into the area, move through it, you know, with a tactic in mind or an approach, locate, move in, set up, work a bird to my location. Or, as I said with this gobbler, as I'm calling, if he has hens, they're going to move away from me. And a lot of times I can figure out where they're going to move, get out in front of them, and then intercept them.
Yep. Yeah, we did the same thing.
And or work them in as they get into that. They hit a certain range where a hen will she won't put up with you anymore, and she'll come in to whoop your ass. Mm-hmm. And then the gobbler comes in tow, because he's not going to leave his harem of hens. So he'll come in, and you can also move in close to a dominant gobbler and actually provoke him by gobbling at him, or hen talking and gobbler talking, and, you know, gobbler yelping, gobbler clucking, and then throw out an immature gobble and actually get him to come over. If you can get close enough to him, he'll come over to steal your hens, or make sure you're not coming to try to steal his.
Do you guys have a term for a gobbler that does not have his own flock of or harem of hens, and is trying to steal the harem?
Dead.
He's a
killable turkey every day, all day. Yeah.
The lonely guys. A lot of times that's the Jakes, right? So they're just kind of being jerks. They bunch up and they try to beat up on a tom, and sometimes then that'll separate the tom.
Jakes are you'll get groups of 2-year-olds, and so they're equivalent. They would be the equivalent of a satellite bull.
Yeah.
The 2-year-olds don't hang out close to the flock, but they won't. They're real careful about how close they get into the gobbler's harem. And it's a very similar situation. Then you have your Jakes that are out on their own. I don't know much about elk hunting, but I'm assuming spike bulls are still within the herd.
They are.
So the Jakes will be outcasted.
Yeah.
And they will normally group up. And what you'll see, and I had a farm that was like this, anytime you would be working in a mature gobbler, the Jakes would just literally flock to him, beat the dog crap out of him, and he would be gone, and then it would come in to take over the vocal hen. It was horrible.
Oh, they are weirdly aggressive. Like a lot of times you'll shoot one and it's laying dead, and the other toms or a few other Jakes will come in and they'll keep beating the crap out of the dead turkey on the ground. It's incredible.
Like I said, man, Garrett, one of these days we'll have to get you out east here.
Heck yeah.
And hunt turkey. Or we'll just come out and kill some birds in Oregon, because I've never killed a
going back to that, that's a Merriam's Rio Grande subspecies that you guys have. Okay. And they weigh up to about 25 pounds, according to the internet.
That's a good look at you, Wikipedia.
That's a neater.
There we go.
You can kill 2 in the spring and I think 1 in the fall. And they're just like possums, you know, or just over here. We get the guys that hunt real hard over here are the ones that are out of town. Like all the guys from here are like, you know, turkeys, what?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, if you guys want an opportunity, or Roseburg, Oregon, and this whole valley is.
That's a far trip for me to hunt a turkey.
Hey,
I'll come out and go elk hunting with you, but I don't know if I'll come out there to go.
Hey, while you're at it, you shoot a turkey while you're elk hunting. You know.
I don't think the tags coincide.
Yeah. And you're hunting Roosevelt. Like the first bull you shot this year was a Roosevelt, right?
Yeah. First bull with my bow. That was a very nice Roosevelt. I was pretty happy with them. It came full circle, because 2 years into bow hunting, we had a family friend who I kept, you know, he's the best elk hunter I knew, and, you know, he killed like over 20 bulls or something like that, and getting it done every year in the same spots I'm hunting. And I'm like, can you just please show me how? And he's like, well, you know, keep at it, and then come to me next year. He just wanted to see if I'd quit. Well, I came to him again, and finally I earned his respect and earned his time. And where he taught me how to elk hunt is actually pretty much right where I killed that bull without him, though.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, by myself. Now, and I actually called him when I got the bull to bugle the first time. I'm like, Willie, I got one, you know, like I got one going. He's like, get off the phone and go kill it, you know. I was like, all right. And then as soon as I got back to service, it's like, Willie, I got him. And it was just so cool. I mean,
it was
probably more emotional than I should admit to, because it was such a long, hard journey. And I had so many opportunities that just didn't go my way. It was like, it was a pretty big moment for me.
Oh, I can relate. I mean, it took me 2 years to kill one with the bow, a gobbler with the bow on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, when I finally put the arrow in him, I was like, I probably shouldn't be crying. I'm a grown man out here. And like, what is going on with me right now? I'm like,
there's water coming out of my
hot
eyes.
Flashes.
yeah,
I could imagine. And then you add the magnitude of that animal and the size, and yeah I mean, it probably multiplies.
Truth be told, I'm not sure if I haven't told the story on a podcast yet, but I've posted about it. I shot a big 6-point last year, Rocky, and that would have been the third bull we got in 4 days. It was the most awesome 4 days of hunting over there. My buddy's wife that got the big bull tag this year killed a 5-point, and then my hunting partner, who'd been with me for 4 years over there, killed a 5-point, and then the next day after my buddy killed his bull, the guy who has the wife that killed that one busted this big 6-point, and I got to hear all about it, how big he was, and he had to go home. And I'm like, crap, you know, like we used to see 1 300 bull in here every year, and that's the only time we're going to see him. Well, another day goes by, and I'm helping my uncle, who's, you know, 40 years old, learning, you know, teach him how to bugle and elk hunt. He's never been out before. And I get this bull going. I'm like, all you have to do is sound like sort of like a bull, and then I'll sneak in there and kill him. So that happens, and I arrow him at 50 yards, pass through, quartered away, no guts on my arrow. I'm like, I just killed a 310-inch 6-point bull. Like, I just did it. It took me this many years, and I start crying. Like, I just, all that, like, emotion and failure and everything, and I'm like, I just needed somebody to call for me. That's all I needed. Like, and then I had this guy who said, I'll call for you. And then because my other buddy was back at camp cutting up the elk, and so I start cow calling them, and then they come up the road, and then as soon as I see Mike, I just start losing it. And he's like, what the hell? What are you doing? This is elk hunting, you know, like, what are you pretty much crying for? Like, just give me a second, okay? So we ended up losing that bull. And about a half hour after that, a severe, with a Weather Channel called it a severe isolated thunderstorm, moved in. And I had a big puddle of blood about the size of a dish plate. And that next morning, you could just see the dried up crust around the perimeter of that circle, because that was the only blood that dried up enough to stay. And I never found it. So got my arrow back and everything, good looking blood. And I actually went and looked for him last weekend a little bit more, because I'm like, I didn't check this one spot. And then we put like 6 miles on the ground in a very small area, gritting back and forth looking for this freaking bull that I had shot. So this year, as soon as I shot that 5-point this year, I called the Born and Raised guys. I don't know if you know who those guys are. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like a new phone call. I'm like, guys, I think I heard him fell over. I'm pretty sure I shot him right where I wanted. And I'm like, what would you guys do? You guys have killed, like, they've killed over 60 or 70 elk. And he's like, sounds like a dead bull. And the other one's like, well, how sure are you? Pretty freaking sure. And he's like, go back in there and look for it tonight. And I ended up finding them the next morning, 45 yards away from where I shot him. It was so thick, I couldn't find him.
Wow.
Yeah. Got all the meat. All the meat was good, but that's how thick it is. And there was no blood. No blood.
Yeah, that's very different than, like, we were out in Colorado last year. That was mostly open. I mean, supposedly for Colorado it was thick, but I mean, for what we're used to, and I'm sure what you're seeing, it was open.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, guys, I gotta end it here. I'm gonna get kicked out of the studio.
They're getting booted.
Jack's giving me the old stinky eye. Actually, Garrett, let's maybe resume this conversation again, because I feel like we could probably talk all night.
Barely scratching the surface, I think.
I could talk all day, man. I love this stuff.
Part Wonderful. Two. Hey, me and you, that's why we get along so well.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, thank you guys.
I just muted my mic and kicked back tonight.
No, you're great.
Thank you, Garrett.
No, Garrett, I appreciate it. You are an awesome resource for people getting into hunting, for people that have been into hunting for a long time. For anybody that doesn't know, where can they find you online?
So I try and be extremely reachable. So if you message me on Instagram, it's On Point with Garrett Weaver, all one word. I will get back to you. Facebook, I will get back to you. On Point with Garrett Weaver there as well. And then the On Point podcast with Garrett Weaver is really, it's this kind of stuff. It's the most in-depth conversations you're going to get. The YouTube videos are great, but if you really want to learn and get inside of it, check out the Arrow episode, check out the Broadhead episode. I mean, I don't cut mine off. Mine go, you know, I think I've had a 3-hour episode one time on Broadhead.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may take you a couple listens, but but you'll get a lot of information out of it. So, and you can always email me at jarrettweaverhunts@gmail.com. So
awesome. Make sure to subscribe to that podcast too.
Yeah. Subscribe to ours. I haven't said it, and I've been told I need to say it. Subscribe and give us a 5-star, even if you think we're 2-star guys. We'd appreciate it.
Because all together we would equal 5 stars.
That's right. Yeah. All together
we're at least one star.
Yeah, we got Garrett here who's bringing the 5 stars from his podcast. Well, so
I bribe people for mine.
Yeah. We have a giveaway.
We got a giveaway.
There you go.
We've got some Broadheads coming your way. Northern Broadheads has been gracious enough to give us a few spare packs. So subscribe, like, and follow, rate, all those things. Give us a thumbs up.
Do everything.
Yep. Thank you, Garrett. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you, everybody, for listening in.
Thanks, guys. See ya.